With the direct cycle nuclear gas turbine, however, dry air cooling offers an economical means of heat rejection. Building on demonstrated HTGR technology, the power industry can develop nuclear gas turbine plants before sites with ample cooling water become unavailable. The nuclear gas turbine with dry air cooling thus represents a significant step toward a more environmentally acceptable and economical means of power generation. The next slide dramatically illustrates the reduction in plant size and number of cooling towers required for the HTGR gas turbine using dry cooling. You see here with the lower efficiency steam cycle nuclear plants, about three cooling towers are required, and these cooling towers represent roughly, in terms of their size, the cost and capacity. The next level down is the high-temperature gas-cooled reactor, which, because of the higher efficiency, allows the use of less cooling tower capacity. And then at the bottom is the direct cycle using the gas turbine. And you see here that only two much smaller cooling towers are required. And you also see that the entire steam plant has been eliminated from the reactor plant. Thus far, our discussion has been restricted to the generation of electricity by advanced reactor concepts, primarily of the gas-cooled type. However, the reactor design and operating conditions of the HTGR can be readily adapted to deliver high-temperature process heat in the quantity and temperature range of interest for many applications. A helium core outlet temperature of 1,450 degrees Fahrenheit is currently used for the power-generating high-temperature gas-cooled reactor. Temperatures up to 1,650 degrees Fahrenheit appear to be attainable with modification to the method of fuel management or by more extensive orificing of the coolant channels. Improvement in fuel particles can further extend this range. Some of the more promising HTGR process heat applications requiring temperatures up to 1,850 degrees include the gasification of coal to produce high BTU pipeline gas and the recovery of bitumen from tar sands. These process heat applications would directly alleviate the shortage of fossil fuels in the United States. A coal gasification plant incorporating a 3,000 megawatt HTGR would process 12 million tons of coal per year, producing some 630 million standard cubic feet of synthetic pipeline gas per day. An important application of nuclear process heat is in the extraction of huge quantities of petroleum from tar sands. In the large Canadian Athabasca deposit, there are enormous quantities of petroleum tightly locked in deposits of sand. In its present form of kerogen, the petroleum is semi-solid and cannot be extracted simply by drilling wells. At the present, it appears that destructive strip mining might be used to make these deposits available for processing. Heat is required to change this tightly bound kerogen to liquid hydrocarbons. We feel sure that nuclear process heat in the form of high-pressure steam will prove to be sufficiently economic to permit the process heat to be injected into the in-situ solid rather than bringing the solid to the surface for exposure to heat. When this method becomes available, a great fuel resource estimated about 700 billion barrels can be tapped with negligible impact on the topography of the land and with no need to dispose of tailings. A similar technique could be used for the recovery of ordinary crude oil, except that there would be a different balance between the steam needed for process and steam needed for electric power generation. This application is likely to be most attractive where there is a good synergism between the recovery operations and nearby utility operations. The fast breeder reactors, in which more fissionable material is produced and consumed, go a step further towards solving part of the energy crisis. In producing power, present-day light water reactors consume only 1 to 2% of the atoms in mined uranium. Breeders would be able to use 70 or 80%. Thus extending the use of existing supplies of nuclear raw materials by about a factor of 40. They are expected, therefore, to surpass converter reactors in satisfying huge power demands of the future. Although major efforts have been directed toward the development of the liquid metal fast breeder reactor, there is currently keen interest in an alternative concept, the gas-cooled fast breeder reactor. The GCFR would require less development work than the LMFBR because it is not based on completely new technology. Technology of the nuclear steam and containment systems is but an extension of that already proven for the high-temperature gas-cooled converter. The fuel used would be essentially the same as that for the liquid metal fast breeder reactor. Based on extensive breeder development work to be done, the breeder could prove economically feasible within the next decade. The timetable for commercial availability is uncertain, but it is generally agreed that there will be competitive breeder plants in the United States by the late 1980s or 1990s. Now let us turn from the breeder reactor, which offers reasonable assurance of alleviating future fuel shortages, to a potentially far better energy source, the controlled thermonuclear fission of nuclei. This yet-to-be-developed concept promises a safer, more economical, and for all practical purposes, infinite source of cheap electric energy utilizing hydrogen isotopes from seawater as the basic fuel. Fusion may be the answer to many environmental problems as well. There will be essentially no radioactive waste from the deuterium-tritium fuel cycle because radioactive tritium produced will in turn be used as fuel. The structural material will probably become highly radioactive and it may have to be discarded periodically. But this consideration is minor compared with the disposal of fission reactor waste. Thermal efficiencies of first-generation fusion reactors will probably be about 40%, which is comparable to those of the most modern fossil fuel plants and the HTGRs. Later plants employing direct conversion devices may achieve thermal efficiencies up to 90%, thus potentially eliminating the problems connected with the discharge of waste heat to the environment. The inherent safety advantages of fusion reactors may also be economic advantages. The cost of transporting and storing radioactive waste will be low, and the reactors can be located virtually in the heart of population centers, cutting power transmission costs and making waste energy available for district heating, refrigeration, and industrial applications. The AEC projects that the scientific feasibility of fusion may be demonstrated by 1980 or 1982 if present plasma containment and heating experiments are successful. The engineering feasibility of fusion reactors must then be proved through small test reactors and experimental power reactors to solve a number of difficult engineering problems. The AEC estimates that expenditures in the range of $1.2 to $2.5 billion are necessary to achieve this stage by the year 1990. The economic feasibility and commercial justification for fusion reactors could be demonstrated by the year 2000 through the construction of a 150-megawatt prototype reactor and a 500-megawatt demonstration plant. This optimistic schedule, with success assumed at all critical points, indicates that commercial fusion power cannot be counted on as an energy alternative until the first decade after the year 2000. It is evident that a long-range, vastly expanded research and development program will be necessary if fusion power is to become a reality. As a point of reference, the AEC is currently sponsoring fusion research programs at the rate of $60 million per year. In summary, then, a number of energy resources for electric power generation will probably coexist for many years. As in the past, the dominance of one source over another will gradually shift. Wood was the dominant fuel supply in the 1880s, giving way to coal by 1900. Coal in turn bowed to oil and natural gas in the 50s, which in turn are now yielding to light water nuclear reactors. Economic, environmental considerations will be prime factors in determining the rapidity and the direction of these shifts. Advanced converter reactors, such as the HTGR, now compete with existing sources. The steam cycle version will be followed by the gas turbine direct cycle system. Then the first generation fast breeder reactors will enter the picture. Fusion reactors should join the spectrum soon after the century. We in the industry see nuclear power as an ally of our fossil fuels to conserve them for more valuable uses, to assist in their efficient conversion to more convenient forms, and to gain access to previously inaccessible fossil fuel resources. We have then the opportunity at this time and the obligation to develop these nuclear energy sources and other clean and economical sources of energy available to us to ensure meeting future power requirements. Rewards for success will be great, a cleaner and more prosperous and safer world. The penalty for failure is intolerable, the deterioration of the quality of life on the Earth. The action we now take will mark our place in history. We will be judged rather harshly, I'm sure, if we lack the initiative and vision to make full and timely use of this opportunity. Thank you very much.
Our next speaker plans to explain what a fast breeder is and how the fast breeder development program stands at the present time. He's a graduate from North Carolina State University, receiving a Bachelor of Science degree in, of all things, civil engineering in 1961. And he graduated from North Carolina State University in 1970 with a Master of Science degree in materials engineering as a major and nuclear engineering as a minor. He was employed with the Tennessee Valley Authority and Hydraulic Laboratory during the period of 1961 to 1963. And from 1963 to 1969, he served as an officer in the U.S. Navy. He was selected for and completed the Navy's Nuclear Power School and subsequently qualified on the Navy's DIG prototype reactor. Johnny, you can tell us what a DIG is in a moment. And also the C-1W and C-2W nuclear propulsion plants as engineer officer of the watch. He served as a boiler's officer on the USS Essex CVS-9. He joined the Duke Power Company in 1969 and presently is senior engineer in the nuclear group of the Mechanical Engineering Division of Design Engineering Department. He's a registered professional engineer in North and South Carolina, and is a member of the American Nuclear Society, and presently secretary to the American Nuclear Society 21 Standards Committee. It's a pleasure for me to introduce Mr. Johnny Elliott, who will talk on the Fast Breeder Reactor Development Program. Johnny?
Mr. Wiley, DIG is D1G, and it stands for a destroyer prototype, the first type constructed by General Electric. First of all, I'm very honored to participate in a program with such a distinguished group of speakers. But as Mr. Keep said, the previous speakers had softened his comments somewhat. Mine are getting downright soggy right now. I'd like to begin our discussion by asking a very basic question about the fast breeder reactor development program, and that's why. Why should we have a breeder? In order to answer that question, I think we need to go back one more question, and why nuclear? And to do that, we need to look at the trilateral problem that's facing us today. First, the rapidly increasing demands for energy, the diminishing fossil fuel supplies, and the environmental considerations. And I submit to you that nuclear does offer the best solution to the equation for the foreseeable future. Nuclear is one of the more economical means to produce power in many areas of our country. Nuclear has a reliable and an economical source of fuel. And it does have many of the better choices from an environmental standpoint. This is the third time you're going to see it, but... Okay, thank you. You're going to see this slide, but what I want to demonstrate to you here is that nuclear costs are in the range of 20 cents per million BTUs, and and its competitor, I guess, coal, was up in the range of 40 to 50 cents per million BTUs. Even though nuclear does represent a greater capital investment, the advantages of the fuel cost itself make it an attractive alternative. Now back to the question of why the breeder. In a speech in June 4, 1971, President Nixon made a statement, and I quote, "Our best hope today for meeting the nation's growing demand for economical, clean energy lies with a fast breeder reactor," end of quote. Although the AEC's predictions indicate that we will have adequate supplies of uranium ore for the satisfy the United States' demands for many years to come, in order to fully realize the benefits of nuclear power, fast breeder reactor must be developed. The effects of the breeder reactor, as indicated earlier, is phenomenal in that it will extend our uranium supplies by a factor of about 40. As indicated before, we presently in the light water reactors, we utilize about 1 to 2% of the uranium that's mined. With the breeder, we move up into the 70 to 80% utilization range. And this is in addition to the elimination of a very costly component of our fuel cycle process, and that is the enrichment cycle. Unlike some of the newer concepts for generating power, such as solar, geothermal, fusion, etc., the fast breeder's feasibility has been demonstrated. And the next step in the development of the fast breeder reactor is to demonstrate that the large commercial size units will provide dependable and economical power sources. To better understand our subject, let's briefly discuss the breeding process. Breeder reactors are similar in many respects to the light water reactors that we are building in many parts of the world today. But the breeders have a unique characteristic in that they produce more fissionable material than they consume. Fundamental to all nuclear reactors today is the fission process. In this process, the impact of a neutron upon a fissionable material will cause the atom to split or to fission, releasing the energy. In order to create this fissionable material, we utilize, in the breeder concept, a so-called fertile material. Now, this material is unique in that it will join with a neutron and combine to form a new fissionable material. And the fissionable material can, in turn, can produce more neutrons through its fissioning process and thus continue the fissioning process. Now that we've understand a little bit about the fissioning material, how it's produced, I'd like to look at one other basic fundamental rule of nature, and that's concerning the number of neutrons that are emitted in the fission occurrence. The number of neutrons that are released per fission will vary with the isotope, but usually it will be greater than 2 neutrons per fission. Since only one neutron is needed to continue the fissioning process, neutrons in excess of 1 are available to interact with the fertile material to produce new fissionable material. Therefore, to be a candidate for the breeding process, the fissioning material must produce more than 2. And actually, in the practical application, it should produce considerably more than that, in that you have some non-productive absorption taking place in the process, which would not sustain your operation. Now that we've understand the breeding phenomenon, I'd like to describe the more popular types of breeders that you may see in the literature. There are the liquid metal fast breeder, the gas-cooled fast breeder, the molten salt breeder reactor, light water breeders, and steam-cooled breeders. As you might note, the name that's used to describe these processes indicate the type of coolant medium that's used in the process. Each has its own advantages and disadvantages in any given particular application. Of these concepts, there are two which seem to have the best chance for to be early contenders for the commercial market or applications. First would be the liquid metal fast breeder reactor, which has received the strongest support in the United States to date. And the other concept would be the gas-cooled fast reactor. I will briefly describe some of the characteristics of each of these. Any given design will be peculiar to the manufacturer, I've selected the liquid metal fast breeder reactor demonstration plant and the gas-cooled fast reactor as my discussion models. Well, let me continue on here. There are three, in the liquid metal fast breeder reactor, there will be three heat transfer loops associated with the reactor. There's a primary loop, an intermediate loop, and a power generation loop. The primary and intermediate loops will utilize sodium as its coolant, and the power generation loop will use the water steam coolant. One might ask at this point, why would sodium be chosen as a potential promising coolant for a fast breeder reactor, since we know that there are several known disadvantages to sodium, such as it has a chemical reaction with air and water, it becomes activated under irradiation, it's opaque, and has a relatively high melting point. However, sodium does have some characteristics which are extremely desirable. It has excellent heat transfer properties, has low pumping power requirements, low system pressure requirements. It has the ability to absorb considerable amount of energy in an emergency, since it does operate at considerable subcool condition. It has a tendency to maintain and hold fission products that might be released to the coolant, and it has favorable neutronic properties. And it also has an extended liquid range in that it melts at about 210 degrees Fahrenheit and boils at about 1640 degrees Fahrenheit. The LMFBR concept was chosen over other concepts principally because of the predicted performance, the industrial support, and a broad base of technology and a proven basic feasibility. The intermediate loop is a safety feature in the LMFBR in that it separates the radioactive sodium from the steam in the power generation loop. This slide gives the core plan. The center region constitutes the core zones. Moving outward, we find the blanket or the fertile region and the reflector zone, and finally the restraint assemblies in the outer perimeter. The core and the blanket assemblies are designed to give a breeding ratio in excess of about 1.2. The core is designed to achieve annual refuelings, with about one-third of the assemblies being replaced each year. Liquid sodium at 740 degrees and about 42.3 million pounds per hour flow in these inlets up through the core and out the outlet here. It divides into the parallel paths to cool the core, the radial blanket, the control assemblies, and the storage fuel assemblies in the vessel. There's orificing that's provided to properly distribute the flow and to limit the mid-wall fuel clad temperature to about 1200 degrees Fahrenheit. After passing through the core, the flow recombines at the outlet plenum and it exits at about 1000 degrees Fahrenheit. A free surface of the liquid sodium is under a argon cover gas. The core assemblies are a ceramic mixture of plutonium and depleted uranium oxides containing about 20% plutonium and about 80% uranium. The blanket itself is a depleted uranium oxide material, and the control rods are made of a boron carbide material. One piece of equipment that might be of interest to this group is the sodium pump. The pump is a single-stage centrifugal-type unit with an axial suction. Primary sodium pumps have the capability of about 34,000 gallons per minute. Capability to load follow and operation at partial power is afforded through a variable speed control of a 5-to-1 speed range hydraulic coupling to a 4,400 horsepower induction-type drive motor. Normal pump speed is about 900 RPM. And the ability to continue operation under a power failure emergency condition is provided through a 250-volt DC power motor coupled to the pump and fed by a diesel emergency power system. The intermediate loops have a similar type pump, and their pumps are rated at about 22,000 gallons per minute. Now I'd like to move to the gas-cooled fast reactor and describe it very briefly. The gas-cooled fast reactor uses a helium as its cooling fuel, a fluid, to qualify for a satisfactory cooling fluid. Helium must be used at high pressure and must be moved through the core very rapidly. Since helium itself does not become radioactive, or react chemically with water as does the sodium, the intermediate loop is not needed. The gas-cooled fast reactor will use the same basic fuel material concepts as would be used in the liquid metal fast reactor. Now that we have developed a basic understanding of the Breeder reactor and what it will mean to the future of nuclear power in our country, I would like to pursue the progress of the Breeder program to date. As a follow-on to the feasibility studies of the 50s and 60s, the next step in the Breeder development is to demonstrate the practicality and the economics of the concept. In this endeavor, the AEC selected a Commonwealth Edison TVA Tennessee Valley Authority proposal to build and operate the first demonstration plant. This proposal was submitted in January of 1972. The project was organized in March of 72, and the site was selected in August of 72. Manufacturers' participation was decided in late 72. And agreements between the parties was initiated in July of this year. In order to implement the LMFBR program, two organizations have been formed in the project management. The Breeder Reactor Corporation, called BRC on the slide here, is a 17-man board representing both investor-owned and consumer-owned utilities, the Edison Electric Institute, the American Public Power Association, and the National Rural Electric Cooperative. The Breeder Reactor Corporation provides senior counsel, manage financial contributions to the project, and serve as liaisons between the nation's utilities, and handles the dissemination of information. The Project Management Corporation, indicated as PMC, includes one representative from the BRC, or the Breeder Reactor Corporation, two from Tennessee Valley Authority, and one from Commonwealth Edison. The PMC will be responsible for the overall design, engineering, and construction of the plant. Commonwealth Edison has provided the project manager and the engineering manager. The TVA will start up and operate and maintain the demonstration plant. Westinghouse was selected as the lead reactor manufacturer. Burns & Rowe was selected as the architect engineer, and Atomics International and General Electric will share in the balance of plant. The LMFBR demonstration plant will be located on the Clinch River near Oak Ridge, Tennessee. The containment will be a right circular cylinder design of about 200 feet in diameter, and the basic containment design questions which remain open are the shape of the head as to whether it'll be ellipsoidal or hemispherical, materials of construction, whether it be steel or reinforced concrete, the size and configuration of the containment airlocks, location of airlocks, and the transfer corridors. After extensive studies, the arrangement of the primary and secondary heat transport systems is expected to be a three identical primary heat transport loops. The primary loops will be have isolation valves for ease of maintenance and good accessibility. There will be an attempt to optimize the use and space and minimize the use of concrete. The capability to incorporate both the reference and the alternate design steam generator modules, as well as the arrangement flexibility for other components as the design progresses. It will have acceptable allowable piping stress levels, including appropriate accommodations for the severe thermal transients that it will see. It will use hot leg pumps, and it will also, primary piping sizes will vary from about 24 to 38 inches in diameter. I have a couple of slides that will show some of the plan and elevation views of equipment layout. I'll move through these rather quickly just to give you some appreciation for the architectural considerations in the plant. Here's some of the thermohydraulic design parameters for the demonstration plant. Note that the LMFBR will operate at a much higher temperature than our present-day burner-type reactors. This feature of high temperatures will create some very special problems for the designer, and such that many of the conventional materials will be severely limited, in some cases precluded from application in the LMFBR. At this point, I feel we should comment on the demonstration plant schedule. The LMFBR schedule presently calls for a 69-month period from award of contract to the fuel loading. Many people feel that this is a very optimistic schedule. However, this is the present objective. Although the gas-cooled fast reactor demonstration plant has not received as much support in the United States as the LMFBR, especially from the federal funding, The gas-cooled fast reactor does have a demonstration plant design, which is presently being developed, and the gas-cooled concept is making some substantial advances and probably will be a strong contender for the fast reactor market. The gas-cooled fast reactor demonstration plant would draw heavily, as previously noted, on the experience from the HTGR design, and would utilize the pre-stressed concrete reactor vessel, helium circulators, and the other features of the gas-cooled fast reactor will probably be extrapolations from the HTGR. The fuel utilized for the gas-cooled fast reactor will seek to use the experience gained in the LMFBR as its building block in its fuel technology. This slide outlines some of the target conditions for the gas-cooled fast reactor fuel program. Note that not only the high temperatures, but also high burnups must be carefully anticipated by the designer. These high exposures cause severe swelling of the fuel-clad materials and damage to the core structural materials due to a high neutron flux. This slide projects some of the design parameters one might expect in a 1,000-megawatt commercial-size reactor. In summary, the consensus of those who have studied and the available sources of energy production and the conversion is that in the relatively near term, say the next 50 years, the U.S. energy requirements must be met by the fossil fuel conventional plants, nuclear reactors operating on the light water principle, supplemented by the HTGR, high-temperature gas reactor, and the breeder reactor. Assuming that some newer energy production ideas such as thermonuclear fusion does, with some reasonable optimism, reach us in the year 2000, it would be at least the year 2020 before a substantial amount of our generation capability would come from these sources. As I stated earlier in my talk, I feel that in order to fully realize nuclear, we must see a timely development in the breeder. Thank you for your attention. Is there going to answer any questions? Yes, sir.
Breeded fuel, the results of it, used in the breeder, or does it have to be extracted and burned in a conventional?
No, it can be used in the breeder as well as in conventional. What you're breeding there is plutonium, and light water reactors today do have the capability for plutonium recycle. Most of them are planned on a self-generated scheme. However, plutonium is plutonium.
Most of the plan is then use it basically to go from 1% efficiency.
Yes, the plan would be to have, say, one breeder reactor and four light water reactors, at which the breeder would essentially be supporting the other light water reactors, as well as its own itself and its part of the power.
In order to get this energy, no matter where I use it, I must extract the plutonium and remake a new...
Yes, you must take the plutonium out, recover it, and refabricate it into assemblies that are... usable, yes.
Dr. John, in that connection, in a light water reactor, what percent of the uranium fuel is converted to plutonium in a fuel change out?
How much? Let me ask you a question again. In other words, from a discharge of say of 30 metric tons, what would be the recovered?
Yeah, what would be the plutonium? Say you load a core and then you take the core out 3 years later, what's the conversion?
Well, I'd say we would recover 200 kilograms. It would be a ballpark figure. Maybe one of these gentlemen could on a given cycle. Keep in mind the light water reactors do some breeding on their own in that they do utilize the plutonium late in life. But
what about the breeder? What about conversion? Well, of course, it's all plutonium. No.
Well, the
plutonium, right?
Yes, 20%.
20% uranium, depleted uranium.
Right, in the core region, and then the outer blanket is all depleted.
That's been through a cycle of 3 years. How much of that is plutonium? How much uranium? You got any
idea? No, I don't. I don't have a good feel for that percentages. Yes, sir.
What sort of control system is used to control the rate of fission?
The same basic concept that's used in a light water reactor. It's a poison inserted in the reactor to terminate the fissioning process. You can think of these controls as being neutron sponges, if you like. And in the case of the breeder, they'll use a boron carbide, whereas in some of the light water reactors, they use boron, cadmium, different types of absorbing material. But the concept is the same. It's a
temperature sensing that provides the feedback without
the
control system.
No, not necessarily. To get that insertion. You mean to get those insertion of that poison to the neutrons?
Primary measurements.
Well, there's several measurements. There's high temperature, low pressure, turbine trips. There's a lot of inputs that could cause a signal of an unsafe condition, which would cause the reactor to shut itself down or actuate the trip. Yes, sir.
What type of moderator do you use?
Type of moderator?
Moderator?
In a breeder, you don't want to use a moderator because you want to use the fast spectrum. That's one of the reasons you use sodium, is because sodium has a very low moderating capability. In the light water reactor, we like to work with the thermal neutrons, which means we like to get these neutrons that are born fast energies down to a thermal energy before it's very receptive to a fissioning process. So in the light water concept, we use water because of the hydrogen atoms, proximity and the size to the neutron, which is a very good moderator, but in the fast breeder, you do not want that. You want to stay with the fast spectrum. Yes, sir?
Is there some problem with fatigue of materials in places that are inaccessible inside the reactor?
Fatigue?
Yes.
Well, yes, but probably no more that problem than any other problem. Are you thinking about fatigue from vibrations?
And heat.
And heat? Now, when you say heat, do you mean creep, or you really mean fatigue in the strictest sense? I associate fatigue with a vibration. Temperature may be a catalyst of sorts. I don't know.
I'm just thinking generally any process which reduces the strength of the structure.
I think basically the problem in the breeder is the fact that you've got this high neutron flux available to your structural materials. And if you're familiar with the high neutron flux, it does have considerable damage to the material. I won't try to go into the details of how this takes place, but basically you get a breakdown within the molecular structure of your material due to this fast neutron bombardment, and you get essentially an embrittlement. Or you may be familiar with the Neal ductility transition temperature that people speak about in many materials. When you get this thing shifting, getting lower, then you run the risk of brittle fracture. But to answer your question, fatigue, creep, swelling, all of these are problems that must be taken into account by the designer. And I wouldn't put fatigue in any higher place than the other aspects.
John, in that connection, you might mention the coupon safety.
Yes, that's a good point. In these reactors, the light water reactors today, and I'm assuming the fast reactors in the future, they do put in, one of the critical components would be the reactor vessel itself, which is very close to this high flux area. They do take sections of material from various heats that are used to build up to make this reactor vessel. And these are placed in the reactor and are taken out periodically, like at the end of the first year, the fifth year, seventh, tenth, 30th year. They take these samples out and subject them to some destructive type tests to try to evaluate what's taking place from the materials damage standpoint in the reactor with regard to Neal ductility, transition temperature, and some other aspects of that's critical to a material. So we do put these samples in that are actually from the heats that we use to make the vessel, and then we take them out periodically and test them to try to get an idea of what's going on inside. Yes, sir?
I understand that the power companies are now making a contribution to a new research effort, which is going to be set up, I believe, out in Stanford or in that area, and this is going to be to look at new possible sources of energy. Is the nuclear breeder reactor one of these, or are you depending on the AEC and its concerns for this?
To answer your question, the utilities are participating in and supporting financially, as well as personnel-wise, the development of the liquid metal fast breeder reactor. Utilities do participate in a lot of research programs, normally through the Edison Electric Institute, which is a sort of a rather than having 15 different utilities carrying on 15 different research programs by channeling their funds into a central operation, hopefully we get more results out of our money by doing that. We can concentrate our efforts in a more
Who does the research for you?
I don't know. I can't answer your question. It's done at various places. I guess the Edison Electric Institute channels these funds.
John, actually, in the fast breeder reactor program, there was something like 90 utilities got money in that.
Yes, in that group that I read off there, there's a significant number. I don't know the number, but this program is talking like $560 million, I think, of which a couple hundred million of that is shared by the utility groups, and the manufacturers are contributing, and of course the AEC is contributing. It's a big joint cooperative program in this demonstration plant that will be built at Oak Ridge. Any other questions? Thank you very much.